My name's German Addict. Well, I do like a small meeting. I was feeling pretty nervous about doing this, actually. I knew I had to show into a microphone. I really don't like hearing the sound of my own voice. And 40 minutes is a long time. And, you know, the first thing I want to do is be kind of clever and witty and charming and funny and tell a good story and kind of be cool, you know. But the fact is I'm just sort of not. And what tends to happen is if I try and pretend to be all of those things, that's when it all goes horribly wrong. I won't talk much about my using, actually. I came from a relatively normal middle-class family. And by normal, I mean kind of, you know, dysfunctional, fucked up, you know, all the standard, you know. You know, I learned throughout, you know, by being in recovery, you know, after a little while, I thought, God, my family's so dysfunctional. And then I realized that everybody else's family was so dysfunctional as well. So when I was 13, we used to live in Cheshire. When I was 13, my mum separated from my dad and we came to London. And I sort of blossomed into a kind of fucked up teenager. And that's when I kind of realized, I think I was 13, and I was a frightened, self-conscious, kind of, you know, I don't know if I was any more frightened and self-conscious and fucked up than any other 13-year-old, to be honest. But my mother had this enormous tub of 10-grain blue Valium, which she'd stopped taking, you know, apparently. So it was nearly full, and she had it by her bed. And I discovered this Valium, age 13. And from the off, it was just, all I wanted was more, you know. And it was one of those things where I took one, and then the next time I took two, and then the next time I took a handful. And I knew that the more I took, at some point she'd notice, right, that, you know, this thing was 500 of them, was gonna get less and less. And I thought, well, I better stop taking them before she notices. And of course I didn't, you know, before, I don't know how long it was, but before too long, I'd done 500 blue 10 grain Valium. And I remember when I first drank, and, you know, all I wanted from the beginning was kind of oblivion. You know, I never wanted to find, you know, feel a little bit drunk or a kind of a little bit out of it. I wanted not to feel anything at all. And I think I must have been 14. I remember my mother walking me around the streets with me puking up everywhere because she'd found me, you know, passed out on the floor of my bedroom. And that was pretty much the pattern for, you know, the rest of my using. When I was about 15, I used to go to a school down in a posh school down in Parliament Square. And really quickly, I kind of learned how to kind of open the back window, climb out, and end up in Leicester Square and Piccadilly Circus. And I discovered that the one thing I was really good at was scoring, right? I could find drugs anywhere, anytime, you know. And I was wearing a school uniform, you know, and I would bunk off, take my tie off, up to Piccadilly Circus, buy some barbiturates or some amphetamines, and spend the rest of the day in the amusement arcades in Leicester Square. You know, and that was it. And when I was, I suppose I must have been about 18, my father, who, you know, I was an obviously fucked up child. So what happened was, when I was about 14, I got sent to see a shrink. So, you know, and I was going to see the shrink three times a week. And I would go, and I would, and this kind of carried on, actually, until I was about 18. So I finally kind of saw the light and stopped going. But I'd go, I'd see this guy, and I'd say, you know, I've got to stop taking these drugs. And he'd say, well, just stop, you know. And after a while, I kind of thought, well, my dad's paying for this, so I might as well get my money's worth. So I take speed on the way in, and then I have a bong on the way out. And the poor guy, I'd go in, and if for 50 minutes, I'd just go, bleh, like this, and then I'd leave. And I did that three times a week. Anyway, the point is that, well, I don't really know what the point is, but I was kind of obviously, that's right. My dad decided that he was going to get me a job, because it was perfectly obvious to everybody that I was never going to get a job left on my own devices. So he got me his job working in this wholesale business in the East End. And, you know, it turned out I was quite good at it. And after a little while, I was running this business, which meant that I had access to lots of cash. None of it mine, but it didn't really matter. And so I started kind of taking money out of this business more and more and more. And pretty quickly, I don't even know how I managed to kind of fool everybody for kind of 2 years. But after 2 years, it all came on top. They found out that I'd taken tens of thousands of pounds out of this business and used to spend half the time in the toilet at work. And when I wasn't in the toilet, I was making excuses to go out so I could be in the pub. And so all of a sudden, I wasn't running this business. And all of a sudden, I was living in this flat where, because all the money I was stealing was going on drugs. And I was living in this flat with almost no furniture in it, with newspaper over all the windows, because I was completely paranoid about people looking in, even though there was nobody for like 200 yards. And I managed to get a job washing dishes in a restaurant in Camden. And I did that for the 2 years before I got clean. And I wasn't really a heroin addict. I'd taken heroin on and off, but, you know, I'm an eldest child, my dad had left, very over-responsible. I thought I was very over-responsible and very responsible. So the idea of having a habit was just too appalling. So I survived mainly on amphetamines, barbiturates, and alcohol for the 2 years that I was washing dishes. And I wasn't eating. I mean, I was, you know, working in this restaurant, and they'd try and feed me kind of creme brulees. And that's why I used to go in, and all I would eat was like creme brulee, no, soft, creamy, sweet things. And the, you know, the chef that did all the desserts would sneak them to me, and I would eat kind of 8 in an evening, and that would be my sustenance, apart from the occasional bowl of cornflakes. So of course, you know, after 2 years of that, I was covered in scabs, weighed about 6 stone, and 2 years prior to that, some guy who I had known when I was using had taken me to an NA meeting in Chelsea. And it was a big meeting, and it was full of, you know, posher people than me, or so I thought. And, you know, I listened to them kind of witter on for an hour and a half and just thought, you know, poor, sad people, you know, this is not how I'm going to end up. I mean, NA for me was absolutely, without question, the last resort. This place is the greatest indignity, as far as I can tell. And he was telling me how wonderful recovery is, and then he probably went off and slept with my girlfriend, so that was it. I thought NA, you know, so that was that. So we get to kind of 1988, and something happened in this restaurant, which wasn't really, I'll go into it later, but it triggered my belief that I needed to do something. You know, all the way through my using, I kind of knew it wasn't the answer. You know, I knew using wasn't the answer, but I never really had the choice. And it was weird. I kind of felt guilty almost all through my using because I knew it wasn't the answer and I knew I ought to know better. But anyway, I phoned up the NA helpline and I got the name, the address of a meeting in Hampstead on a Wednesday night. And I went along, and I think it started at 7:30. And I got there right on the dot of 7:30, and there were 2 seats free at the back of the room. And I sat in these 2 seats, and you know, I was kind of withdrawing, and I was sweating, and I don't really know what I heard, but I heard something, and I made myself go back the next week. And I might have heard someone say, do 90 meetings in 90 days, but it didn't, you know, it was all I could do was to go to one meeting a week. The terror of turning up in a room full of people who I didn't know, you know, and I didn't know what NA was, and I didn't know what I needed, you know. I mean, I didn't even know what help was. When I was using, you know, people tried to help me, and I hated it, you know, I absolutely hated it. So the following Wednesday I went back, but on the Monday I'd start feeling sick about the fact that I'd made the decision to go back to this meeting on a Wednesday. And I always tell this because it's, you know, kind of getting into NA was actually quite hard. You know, it wasn't a kind of easy thing. I didn't kind of come and suddenly hallelujah and everything's fantastic. I discovered at the back, every time I would turn up at this meeting, because I went for about, it must have been the best part of 3 months, once a week. And there would always be these two seats free at the back of this meeting. And the reason they were free was there was an enormous heater behind them and nobody else wanted to sit in them. So I would go and I would sit down and I would sweat for an hour and a half and feel horribly uncomfortable. And then, so of course, I got clever after about a month and started taking water, lots of water. And I would sit in the back of them and I would drink lots of water. So of course, after about half an hour, I'd be dying for a piss. But the toilet was on the other side of the room. And I couldn't get up and walk across the room to go to the toilet. You know, crippled, absolutely crippled. You know, not what you would call a cool human being, you know, no matter what I thought. I mean, my thing about coming to meetings at that time was that the idea was I would come to meetings and look and behave like everybody else who'd been around for years, so nobody would really notice that I was a newcomer. So I could sort of slip in without, you know, kind of do a bit of this recovery thing and try and stop using. You know, and people would kind of say hello and put their arm around me, and I hated it. And but at some point, I must have heard something that kept me coming back. And I remember going to one meeting after a few months, and the sort of penny dropped. I heard somebody talking about feelings that I had and thoughts that I had that I'd never identified and never had the words to express. I never really had anybody to tell, actually. And that was the key. You know, suddenly I was able to identify. And there was this guy there who seemed pretty cool, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said yes. And, I, you know, even at that point, it turned out later that I wasn't prepared to do whatever it took to kind of stay clean. And I, you know, things got a lot better pretty quickly. You know, my manageability got better quickly. I suddenly found myself being able to kind of pay bills and kind of do work and go to coffee shops and kind of, you know, shoot the shit with people. But I was really miserable before I got clean. I mean, it turned out that actually I was still really miserable even though I was clean. And a part of me, you know, it says somewhere in the readings about having reservations and we have to let go of our reservations. And I was somehow convinced that I could do this thing that everybody was doing without sharing and without working the steps. You know, I'd look at the thing and it would say God, and I would cringe. And I would hear people talking about God in meetings and I would feel sorry for them. In much the same way as, you know, when I was running this business, I discovered that I used to have to drive down through the city into the East End. And I discovered that if I drank about half a bottle of neat scotch just before I got into the car, by the time I was kind of arriving into the city, I was feeling okay. And I would see people kind of going to work. And I couldn't understand how they did it without drugs. I just couldn't. It was beyond me. And I would see people holding hands, you know, men and women holding hands in the park. And I would just think, you're deluding yourselves. You know, you're not really in love. You know, this is sad and pathetic. And you'll find out, you know, one day, you know, that this is a kind of, you don't understand the tragic dimensions of existence, right? And I thought that I was always, you know, being happy was something that I was kind of genetically barred from being. I didn't really know what being happy was, but I just knew that, you know, I was never going to be happy. So I'd go to meetings, and I didn't do 1990, but kind of never mind. And I didn't like the idea of God, and I didn't like the idea of working the steps, but I really liked the idea of being clean. What I didn't like was being clean and being miserable. And the thing I found most difficult about these NA meetings was sharing in meetings. I could not do it. And when I say I could not do it, I mean, I really mean I could not do it. In 3 years, I think I probably shared 5 times. And each time was an absolute fucking nightmare. If I went to meetings where people would pass the book, you know, there used to be meetings where people would pass the book and you'd have to read something out. You know, if the book was over there, my heart would start beating. And I would be sitting here praying that the reading would finish before it got to me. You know, I did not want to be the center of attention. I did not want people to kind of know that I was nervous and frightened and fearful and, you know, and needed help. I did not want people to know. So I didn't share. And I developed strategies for not sharing, which meant that I wouldn't go to the same meeting more than 3 or 4 weeks in a row, because then people would notice that I wasn't sharing. And they might come and talk to me and ask me why I wasn't sharing, and I'd have to, you know, lie or something. Somebody said do service. So, okay, there's the Clean Times magazine, and back then, you know, the Clean Times magazine was a bunch of people who would meet once a month in an Indian restaurant and just take the piss out of people, basically, and that was my, you know, that was my idea of service. And there was a guy, you know, who was the chair who would just thump his fist on the table and say, no poetry, you know, and that was right, meeting over, you know. And but I did the best I could with my reservations. But the thing was that, you know, the sharing thing is crucial. And really for me, apart from all the kind of self-consciousness and stuff, it was a manifestation of my inability to kind of let go of whatever reservations I had, you know. And there were obvious reservations that I'd let go of. I was convinced for about 6 months that, you know, this was like the Moonies, and at some point, you know, everybody would turn around and say, oh, we got you, you know, actually this is not, you know, NA is about people having group sex or something, you know. So reservations, yeah. And then one day I used, and what had happened was I'd gone to fewer and fewer meetings because I wasn't really involved. And I was going out with this girl and she'd left some booze around at the flat. And the next thing I know, I'm using. And that was scary, not because I suddenly found myself scoring in Piccadilly Circus, but because I told myself, well, I've tried NA and it hasn't worked. So now what are my options? You know, this, it felt like my last chance, and it was. I mean, it was my last chance, and the only alternative to this horrible indignity of sitting in a room full of people and being kind of sweaty and frightened was dying, you know, fast. And I was frightened, you know, I was really frightened, and I took myself on a Wednesday night, I think it was, to a meeting in St. Charles's over in West London. And there was a guy there doing the share, and he just talked about the steps, the whole share. And my previous sponsor, from the nearly 3 years that I'd been around before I used, had used about 6 months before I did. And I figured, you know, if I'm a good sponsor, I'll use as well. Good sponsee, I'll use as well, or something, I don't know. But anyway, the fact is I used. And asked him to be my sponsor, and he said yes. And that for me really was the beginning of my recovery. You know, that was when I became willing to do whatever it took. And he was from New Zealand, this guy, and he had a really, really irritating New Zealand accent. And, you know, I thought my problems were more involved and more special than everybody else's. And being kind of special is a theme that kind of has run through my recovery. Am I using? And so I would phone him up and I would witter, you know, oh God, this is going wrong, that's going on, and he'd hear me out for about 7 minutes, and I think he must have had a stopwatch because it was always about 7 minutes, and then he'd say, do you want to get better? And I'd say, yes, John. He'd say, go to a meeting, and I'd say, yeah, but you know, I'm different, and it's like, it's all right for everybody else, but you know, I need something more. And he'd say, talk to a newcomer, you know, and this was all stuff I'd heard around. But what I wanted was something special and different, because I'm special and different, and you know, this kind of 12 steps, it might work for everybody else, but I need something really involved and special, and preferably that costs a lot of money, that you can only get in somewhere that I've never heard of, you know. And but I listened to him, and you know, I'd say, look, you know, I find this sharing really difficult. He'd say, find small meetings. So I found small meetings. And when I say small, I mean like four people. And the good thing about having a meeting that lasts for an hour with four people is that, you know, somebody's going to notice if you're not sharing, because there's 35 minutes of airtime to fill, you know, after a 10-minute share. So, you know, so, and I found this meeting in Shepherd's Bush, and I'd go along, and it was on a Friday lunchtime, and I would, you know, the first time I went, you know, it was all I could do was to identify myself as an addict and then collapse in a sweaty heap on the chair. You know, my heart would be beating, and you know, and all the rest of it. And but slowly, I kind of learned how to share. And you know, slowly, I felt better. And it wasn't purely as a result of the sharing, but I felt as though suddenly, you know, I felt as though I belonged. You know, I knew I was an addict. I didn't have any problems with being powerless. You know, it's that funny thing for me. Almost a minute after that kind of surrender, that kind of admission that I'm an addict, almost a minute after, I had this thing, well, of course you're an addict. It's perfectly obvious. Look at your record, you know. I've always known. And the other thing for me is, you know, and I don't think I'm alone, is that it's very, you know, I have this thing. It's very easy for me to kind of fall into regret about kind of being an addict, or it was in the early days. You know, and I'd be going along to lots of meetings, and then one day, you know, I'm bored. You know, I was kind of interested there for a while, but I'm bored now. And, you know, maybe NA isn't really for me. And what stops me, you know, if I go to a lot of meetings and I'm doing service, that stops that from happening. You know, and it took kind of 3 years and a relapse to learn that for me. And so there I am, you know, something's changed. I'm going to some meetings, and this guy got me working the steps. And I don't quite know what kind of method it is. It might have been some weird New Zealand method, but it was like, okay, step one, read the book and give me a page and no more on what it means to you. I went and I shared it with him. And, you know, like I said, the unmanageability, the kind of superficial unmanageability cleared up pretty quick for me. But then there's the other kind of unmanageability, which, you know, is still with me. And, you know, it has been with me since the day I was born. And, you know, it's been a painful process of learning that actually I am not in control over most of the stuff that goes on. I mean, what I do counts. I'm just not in control of the results. You know, I get to vote. I get to kind of put the footwork in. But anyway, so step one, step two was the same. And I had a bit of a problem with step two. You know, this idea of insanity for me was, it wasn't so much that I minded being called insane. I just sort of didn't really know what it meant, actually. And what it's come to mean is, is that the single mistake that I have always made and I continue to make in recovery and that gives me the greatest grief is to kind of believe that I'm in charge, you know, and take my will and my life back, which I do constantly. You know, I'm one of these people, I'm very good, right, at handing my will and my life over when just enough of my will, you know, when I've managed to manipulate and do just enough of my will to feel okay about handing over the last bit. Right, which isn't really handing my will and my life over. It's kind of controlling as much as I can and then collapsing in a heap and going, oh, fuck it, you know. So, you know, the insanity and the power greater than myself, you know, God, couldn't be dealing with that at all. The furthest I got was, okay, you know, something weird happens when I come to these meetings, you know, and something weird happens when you get a bunch of people, you know, trying to kind of stay clean a day at a time. And that was the power greater than myself, you know, for a long time for me. It was NA. And, you know, to a large part, actually, it still is. I don't have a kind of beardy, sitting on a cloud kind of God. You know, and then we kind of worked on to step three, and that, you know, it is, it's a decision. And, you know, he said, oh, it's really simple, you know, and like, you always get these people with a bit of time and they always say how simple it is, you know. But I spent kind of 10 years trying to work it out, actually. you know, and I could have really involved and what I thought were really interesting kind of conversations about the nature of recovery and the steps. And, you know, I thought I was being clever and interesting. And actually, I wasn't. And I don't really know kind of what goes on or how it works. But it's just making a decision to be happy, you know. And, you know, if I accept that I'm not in charge most of the time, then I have to kind of hand it over. You know, otherwise, what else is there? So here I am, bumbling along in recovery, sharing. Suddenly I'm part of the gang. Things are okay. I can go and drink coffee and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But things didn't really start to change for me until I did the step four, actually. And by this time, the New Zealander had gone back to New Zealand, and I got myself another sponsor. And I had to do this kind of column method, step four, where you kind of write down the person, the resentment, the cause, and then you leave the, there's an, another column for defects. And I didn't really understand about defects. And he said, just leave that column blank. And I had to write, I had to go back to the beginning, the first things I could remember, and write down everybody to whom I held a resentment, everybody. And there were different kind of parts of it. And there was a sexual inventory, which of course I kind of put off to last. But it kind of turned out that I resented, actually that was the second full step I'd done. The first one was sort of like a life story. Actually, that was quite weird. This New Zealander, he said, just write, I know that's why there was a leaflet, there's an NA leaflet somewhere, and he said, do it like that. So I kind of wrote it all down, and he came around to this flat I was living in, and he sat silently the whole time. I don't know how long it took me to read this step for, but it must have been about 3 hours. And then he said, right, and he got up and he left. And I was like, well, you know, now what? Kind of, and to be honest, this was quite a long time ago, so I don't really remember. I don't even remember if I spoke to him about it. I don't remember if it was just before he was getting on a plane. I probably timed it so it was just before he was getting on a plane, so there'd be nobody in the country who'd actually had to listen to this stuff and knew, you know, the kind of. Anyway, so this was my second step four, and you know, it turned out that I resented just about everybody I'd ever met, right? Really, you know, my first resentment was to the woman next door. I must have been six or something, and I, you know, the woman next door had a dog that didn't like me, and I hated her for it, you know. And by this time, I'm like, you know, I must have been 28 or something, you know, and I still hate her, you know, because her dog didn't like me, right? And but the thing is, you know, writing all this stuff down, what it did was, you know, I'm an addict and I'm grandiose, and I like to think, you know, when I kind of tell the stories I like to tell are the kind of the thieving and the this and the that and the being down the dilly with the barbs and the passing out and the, you know, and all the stuff. But actually, you know, I had lived a pretty pathetic life. You know, and you know, the petty, all the pettiness actually was the hardest stuff to write down in my step four, and all the pettiness was the hardest stuff to share. You know, I can share, yeah, you know, I stole tens of thousands of this and that, but the things I found the hardest to share were the things when I was working in this restaurant in Camden Town. It was right next to Dingwalls, strangely, and. You know, I was washing up out the back, and I'd looked out of the back one day, and I saw some drunk guy getting beaten up by the bouncers out of the club. And I pretended I hadn't seen it, because I didn't want to go out and start. I was frightened. I didn't want to go out and start trying to kind of interfere with these bouncers. So I pretended I hadn't seen it. And then, of course, 5 minutes later, the manageress of this restaurant was about 4'6", and she just came flying out of the restaurant doors and steamed into these two guys. And I just felt so ashamed that I hadn't done anything and hadn't said anything. And I'd never told anybody, you know. And it was, you know, the petty acts of cowardice were by far the hardest stuff to kind of talk about in my step four. So I did this step four, and I learned about, my sponsor gave me this finite list of 14 defects of character. And three feelings, actually, is what he gave me. And the feelings were, are fear, anger, and guilt. And what he said was that there's also love, but love doesn't actually cause us any problems. It's the fear, anger, and the guilt that causes the problems. Pretty much everything that I'm feeling, if I think about it hard enough, can be reduced to one of those three feelings. and pretty every resentment that I have can be reduced to one of the finite 14 lists of defects of character. And they're like pride, arrogance, self-pity, self-centeredness, greed, gluttony, lust, and others. And suddenly it was like I had a set of tools by which I could understand this stuff, because I had, you know, all my life I had felt that my internal life, my emotional life, had been dictated to by what has gone on outside of me. And it was another one of those things I always knew wasn't right somehow. I always knew that this shouldn't be the way it is, that I should have my, not just my emotional, but my moods dictated to. You know, and this carried on into recovery, and I could be having a perfectly okay day, out on a sunny day, and then for some unknown reason, I'd start to be feeling a bit depressed, you know. And then about an hour later, actually, I feel pretty depressed. And then about an hour later, I'm in the flat and I'm not really answering the phone and I've got the telly on and I don't go out for 3 days, you know. And this used to happen to me a lot. You know, I would get depressed where I would not leave and where going to buy a pint of milk was a major kind of operation, and I'd take an hour in front of the mirror. You know, the shop, it's not like, it was downstairs. I mean, the shop was literally downstairs and across the road, but it was a, you know. And what it turned out was that my pride is so overwhelming and my ego is so overwhelming that what happens to me is that if I go into a shop and I smile at someone behind the counter when I'm buying something and they don't smile back, that is enough to send me into a 3-day depression, right? But I don't realize it at the time, and what happens is I'll smile and they don't smile, but then, you know, the definitions of these defects, pride was, the little definition my sponsor gave me was fear of what I or others think of me, right? And he also wrote down when I was doing this step 4, you can resent yourself. Now, actually, I ignored that you can resent yourself bit for about another 8 years, but I'll go into that later. But pride, what I or others think of me. And what would happen is I would smile at someone, and they wouldn't smile back, and straight away I'd be, fuck, you're no good. You've never been any good. You're never going to be any good. Straight away I get the self-pity. You know, poor you, why you? You know, why is you? You know, everybody else doesn't get this. You know, why, you know, and I'm off. Right, that's it. Suddenly, I can't leave the house for 3 days. Right. So now I've got this kind of set of tools by which I can. Now it doesn't mean that suddenly these things stopped happening. I would still go to a baker's and smile at a girl behind the counter, and she wouldn't smile back. And I'd still, this stuff would still start to happen. But I could phone someone up and laugh about it, and I could phone someone up and say, "Fuck, you know, my pride, man. I went in and this girl and she didn't smile, and I feel like killing myself." You know, and like that bad, you know, the floor can open up underneath me and my mood will drop 10 stories in an instant, right? So step 4, so I have this set of tools, and in a way it made, apart from the fact that it made perfect sense, it kind of made my life both easier and much harder at the same time. Because what happened is I had all this information about kind of how fucked up I am, right? And I've got all these defects. You know, and you hear people sometimes say, oh, I don't like the word defects. I'm going to call them non-assets, right? Which really irritates me. But I understand why, because my instant reaction to finding out that there's something wrong with me is like, right, I'm going to fix this, okay? And which is actually precisely the opposite of step 7. Step 6, you know, I've done my step 5, I've shared it. And step 6 is becoming entirely ready to have these defects removed. So, right, I'm going to remove them. And how am I going to remove? Right, I am not going to be lustful, right? I'm going to be able to kind of walk around town or something. I'm not going to be lustful. I'm not going to have any pride, and I'm not going to feel sorry for myself. Well, not a fucking chance, right? So what happens is I'm failing constantly, right? But through an effort of will, I've decided, you know, and I think, right, acupuncture, that's the answer. I'll do lots of acupuncture, and then I won't, you know, I'm saying, not, and then I hear someone talking about rebirthing. I'll do that. You know, fine. Actually, I didn't. But, you know, that, you know, is my thing. I'll deal with this, right? And that kind of I'll deal. And so what happened is I've got this list of defects. So, and the way I kind of think about it is, right, you know, I'm really fucked up. and it's all because of these defects, I'm going to deal with it. And so there I am trying to deal with it, and it's just not happening, right? I still have the pride, and I still have, of course, right? You know, because everybody's got these things, and they're not anything special, actually. What's special is how I kind of, how my oversensitivity tends to kind of expand these things. You know, it's like a gas, it expands to fill the available space. Well, these things will expand to fill the available negativity, you know, and I've got plenty of room for it. So what happened to me was I spent 18 months feeling shit, trying to, you know, being determined I was going to rid myself of these defects of character. Fuck me, 5 minutes. Oh, that's throwing me. We're only on step seven. So you're lucky. And in step seven, it says, we humbly ask to have our shortcomings removed. And I wasn't humbly asking anything. I'd made the decision I was going to get well and get better and transform myself into a better human being. And I suddenly, I had a bit of an epiphany, right? And I suddenly realized I had never in my life done anything for another human being that wasn't somehow based on self-interest, right? You know, if I helped an old lady across the street, it wasn't because I was genuinely concerned about the old lady. I'd be waiting for the applause once I got her to the other side. And if I even, you know, if I wasn't standing there waiting for it inside, I'm looking around going, did anybody notice that I helped this old lady, you know? And I did have this sort of, and for me it was a kind of complete shift in the way that I kind of see the world. And it stopped being about me. You know, the core of this illness is self-centeredness, and I am chronically self-centered. And, you know, I need this fellowship and I need these steps to turn my face outwards to the rest of the world. It is no big surprise I spent most of my using in toilets, you know, the smallest, grottiest little, you know, and suddenly, you know, I'm able to look out of the world and actually genuinely feel like doing stuff for other people. And it doesn't mean that I'm kind of fantastic and I kind of work for Oxfam and do all, you know, it's a daily battle. Every morning I wake up and if I smile at someone in the Baker's, it's a battle, right? And they don't smile back. How long have I got? About another 2 minutes, 1 minute. I'll tell one quick thing, just because the fact is that, you know, all this recovery stuff has happened to me. You know, actually there's very little of it I've had to actually do. Most of my kind of adult life, I had managed to kind of go out with women who were like my mother, right? And, you know, negative, depressed, suicidal, you know. And no matter how much I tried not to go out with women like this, they always ended up being negative, depressed. It's true. You know, and I'd choose healthy eaters and, you know, and they'd be smiling and laughing. 3 weeks later, I'd find them in the toilet, either throwing up or trying to slash their wrists. And this went on for years, you know, and I've been in therapy, since the age of 14. I knew what I was doing. I just, you know, and I thought, right, I'm going to change. And it didn't change. And then I was going out with this girl in recovery. And one day she left me, suddenly. She went on a kind of, you know, a weekend instant enlightenment course and decided that the best thing she could do with her life was to dump me. And she was probably right, but I was devastated, absolutely devastated. I'd never had anything like this in my life. Suddenly I'm crying every day. I haven't cried for 15 years. I think I'm going mad. I'm phoning my sponsor up. He's saying, well, you know, I mean, you know, I'm going mad. He's going, well, meditate, you know. And this went on for months. And he said, right, and I wrote. Anyway, the upshot what is that kind of after this kind of period of kind of immense change triggered by this woman leaving me, I suddenly just found different women attractive. I no longer wanted to sleep with addicts and, you know, or using addicts or, you know, people who are obviously fucked up, obviously depressed. And it wasn't because it was a decision I'd made. It was, you know, just as a result somehow of coming here and doing my shit and, you know, things change. And I, you know, as long as I stay clean, I'm involved in a process. And, you know, I have recovered from stuff that I never thought I'd recover from, actually, in these rooms, apart from active using. And actually a lot of the time I am happy, you know, and it's not a kind of skipping around, singing kind of happy, but as a byproduct of the way I live, you know, I have a great life now, you know, and I've got a wife, two kids and all the rest of it. And I love it, you know, and I am like these two people holding hands that I despised, you know, 20 odd years ago. So keep coming back and it works. That's it. Thanks.